Dr. Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about Chasing the Sun by Richard Cohen, the epic story of the star that gives us life. We're up to chapter 31, entitled The Impossible and Beyond. So this looks at the sun in science fiction, and part of the general rehab, if at all, I'm trying to at least advance read, skim read things first, give a bit of a commentary at the front to put things into context, sort of rather than read it along and develop the context, which is more difficult to read. And so this is the origin of science fiction. And for a while, I've got a sort of a few, if you could say, feedback that this is an incredibly important area. And initially, when you go into a culture stuff like that, you don't have it signposted. This is the critical. This is the Clausewitz in his strategy, military strategy, called it center of mass. This is the thing that, if controlled, changes the entire dynamic, allows you to gain control of it. And you don't have control of it because you don't want to have control of the situation. And it's often not absolutely apparent until you go in there. It actually requires a lot of brain power, a lot of intelligence to work it out. And in general, so I'm saying that the science fiction, who's allowed to have science fiction, where does it come from, and what's the scope of it, and how one looks at it, that is critical to our society. And I've just got the hunch that it is, and the hunch that I've got is that it's such a hotly contested topic, and it's a topic people are prepared to, without thought, lie about. I do say lie. Now, at a particular stage, so I'll go into a story about this interaction, science fiction, and to go ahead. So the situation was that my daughter was studying the genre of science fiction in English, as you do. I think year 8 it was, or probably early year 8. And they were talking about the earliest science fiction in the 1930s. And I said, oh, look, I think I pretty well know the first science fiction. And bear in mind that I'm now, due to in-depth knowledge, know that there's further grades on this, but I said it was Francis Bacon and his The New Atlantis, because I had researched Francis Bacon, researched The New Atlantis, read The New Atlantis, podcasted The New Atlantis. The New Atlantis is a Francis Bacon, a Elizabethan science fiction in which this group of religious people travel to an island and a new version of the Bible comes down, and people live in a scientific colony researching. And essentially this science fiction of Francis Bacon, called The New Atlantis, is the root, the doctrine of the current culture of science. The religion of science comes back down to this science fiction work, and it comes back down to the American Constitution. And it's cited all over the place, and it's also the basis of British colonization of America. It's just a sort of a seminal piece of work. So it is science fiction. So what happens is that this is a lost colony which is broken off. They've got the original information from the Bible, so that's been preserved, and then there's this alien light comes down and a new Bible is given, and they do various research. Now, it's also important in that further science fiction, which is Gulliver's Travel, which is a direct parody of the New Atlantis. Now, as I said before, this is just a side thing, but this person came in, I'm not going to say who it was, came in and said, oh, look, Francis Bacon didn't write that, Shakespeare wrote it. This is a bit crazy. And then they came in to sever that line of information about the New Atlantis. And I don't know whether it will be in here. in this chapter, I've only skimmed it. The important thing is that I objected, and then when I tried to put up sheets of paper, like the front page of the New Atlantis, and to set up, no, there's no argument here. Your research does not correspond to this person who, in the 1990s, got a degree in English literature. And this person later admitted, oh, I got muddled up. I think it is actually that some of Shakespeare's works is written by Francis Bacon. So Francis Bacon was a courtier, basically a lawyer, scientist, seminal science in Elizabethan England. So there's Roger Bacon, who got a bit of scientific method and laboratory method. Francis Bacon fused that into a religious viewpoint, So Roger Bacon, a friar and a religious thing, was involved in religion. Francis Bacon was a legal person, so it's sort of like science is transforming from its nature in religion to a more a civil one. I suppose getting back to the important point is that this person, although they've privately admitted it, that there is... they've mucked things up in the wrong. They won't publicly admit it. They'll just keep on going. And you reflect what is happening here. There's, you know, why would you do that? Why, if you've made a mistake as a scientist, the idea is to correct the mistake. And there's a whole series of things. And now, albeit comes along, I began to research Plato and the way Plato is storied. And then Parmenides, and Parmenides comes up with, probably 600 BC. No, it must have been, I was trying to re-logic, probably about 400 BC, came up with a poem. And the poem is a story about a spacecraft, which is a chariot with these women riding on horses, and it takes him up to the sun, and there he learns about science, and he learns something that, look, there's lots and lots of stories about it, and it's really rigorously hard to read, because what happens is that the original poem is lost, and people are putting it together like, you know, picking pages of a book which has been with no page numbers, which has been spread around the garden. They come in, some are walked along, and they've got most of it together and commentaries and sticking it together. And then every once in a while they say, that chapter should go here and it has this. And it's still in vogue. But this indeed is a religious work, a philosophical work, but a work of science fiction. And when you look at it, science fiction is, I think there's a word here, is delving with the impossible, the future, the beyond the reality of society, and that is this is an area which is very well policed by society. How society defines itself gives the rules and stuff. So if you operate outside the rules, you're either criminal or you're excluded from society. And so this is where people's will to exclude people from society comes in, and they say, they will come in and break your argument, and then when the methodology of breaking your argument is disproved, they will privately say, well, I'm not interested in repairing that because I'm more interested in the outcome, which is society keeps on. So we really guard science fiction, and science fiction's got a very important point. Now, this is really interesting because it's H.G. Wells described the atomic bomb, and his description, which is science fiction, and then that science fiction came into the nuclear age. It's this pretty amazing stuff. You've got Frankenstein, all the science fiction, our imaginings of the future. So we have a sort of imagining, a reconstruction of the past, trying to understand the past has happened, and all we have is these artifacts around us, and we try and reimagine it. And then we've got an equal fascination with the future. However, it's very dangerous, the actual future. And what's interesting here is that this theme comes across with the sun. It's very interesting. The sun is a religious structuring, and our imagination in the future is a structure. So these are two related structures. And this person quotes people intermediate between the people that I've researched, who I say is the first science fiction, and I will put my foot down. I had initially thought Francis Bacon, but as I study more, I think Parmenides. He's a Greek person who sort of was a generation before Plato. Sort of Plato refers to him, and a lot of the knowledge is inferred. People say, well, if they said this, they must have thought that there's this sort of like forensic circumstantial evidence that you sit in court and there's a jury system. And of course, if it's threatening, you can easily wipe this out and set everyone else that science fiction is set by NASA and Elon Musk. They said it. Anybody else? You've got a real hard problem. So there's this problem getting forward. And so you've got the generic, the large scale of who can set it. And then you've got the small scale of someone, of the people locally, just injecting, I suppose, putting spanners in the work of what you're trying to do. And it's only that you're saying, why put a spanner in there? Oh, this is, so they haven't computed it's important, but they have imputed that it's important because it's important to keep control and origin. So that's an interesting thing here. Now he, really importantly, talks about an ancient person, 200 AD, so that's a full 700 years after Parmenides, and he talks about going to the Mars and Moon and like this. And so what we have is that we have a picture, if you can imagine, a photograph of the back, and people have pressed sketch, and so it's lost all its contrast, its three-dimensionality, and it's all you do is get a three-dimensional sketch, and as you research on, you say, oh, this is, that comes out. There's only a small section which is in three dimension. And of course, as you really probe in, because three dimension helps you explain what you see two-dimensionally, I was going in to look at the origin of mass and matter and energy and these basic things to explain are these terms actually understood or declarative? So for me, there's a induction, an inference-based induction way of thinking. There's also declarative stuff. So if we actually embed these concepts into our language and we teach language by declaration, which is a customary thing, we can actually do fake science to do damage like that. So there's a big interest, and you come in and you start to see this in three dimensions coming up, and you see, oh, this is not the start of science fiction. Science fiction has been going along, well, pretty well, as long as humanity has begun to say, we are progressing. Our world exists beyond what I can see, the animals that fly into it. Our world is a future world, a progress. So a concept of progress and science fiction have come together, and we look at them, and where one might go is the preference of strictly controlled by social hierarchy. So you've got this behind the scenes mechanism to control science fiction, or who can play with science fiction. Now, if I can say that a researcher is in the realm between one foot in our world and the next foot is in science fiction, and what they do is that they just make the both feet in the real world, that they do it so they can imagine science fiction, what if, and they say, well, I may make mistakes, what if, but I can actually they're about transforming it across. So your researcher has a different approach to your practitioner, who is concerned about keeping everything within the power regime. They're concerned about who gets the cut of meat, who gets the money, how things are done, who gets power. And so a researcher is at conflict between the two, and you can definitely see the law of conflict. So I'm going to start to read this. I hope this is a bit better, and I hope I'm a bit more coherent discussing this, having read a bit ahead. So as people will have heard, some getting up to 1,500 podcasts, just reading across, it's the continuous practice, and then layering on technique beyond technique. And so I've just layered on the technique of pre-reading the work before I go into it. Now, you may think this is normal, but if you pre-read work, you start to rehearse how you're going to do it. If you read it in detail, and that clogs up your mind. And of course, I've got limited mind capacity. So the first book, the first quote here, The Impossible and Beyond, it's by Arthur C. Clarke. So he's the person who, in science fiction, declared a whole series of his work is a touchstone to what we thought the Venus and the other planets would be like, and it's also a touchstone to geostationary satellites, our use of satellites for communication, not for location, geolocation. They're a different set. These are fixed stars above our head. Are these satellites. So he's produced it. So he is a practitioner of one foot in advance. Now, our science fiction writers are people who we say were sanctioned and, could they be right? Could they be wrong? Whereas someone who is not a science fiction writer, you are wrong, you should be punished. Now, let's read it. When law number one, when a distinguished but elderly scientist says that something is possible, he is almost certainly right. When he says something is impossible, he is very probably wrong. Okay, did you like the way that he says a distinguished but elderly scientist? This is someone who is not going to threaten the power system. Law two. The only way of discovering the limits of possible is to venture a little way past them to the impossible. That is, to be a researcher to the impossible. This is stuff like that. Any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. And so, to allow magic is to allow the impossible to happen. I would say it's beautiful. Now, H.G. Wells, another science fiction writer and the inventor of the atomic bomb, he says, one cannot choose but wonder from the time machine. The time machine is a pretty interesting thing because I think it went forward in time to people who were just eating each other. Okay, for nearly 2,000 years, writers of what we now call science fiction have been conjuring up scenarios involving the sun. Now, that is interesting because I think we should say it is now called science fiction, but it is part of a bigger thing of impossible curiosity. I think it's beautiful that he said this. In the earliest days of the genre, their stories tended to reflect values and concerns of their age, but had little in common with anything that we would today think of as science. Perhaps. As time passed on, man's knowledge of his universe grew. Writers of science fiction, never sci-fi, they insist, began to anticipate, sometimes by hundreds of years, the discoveries of scientists, so that academic discipline and literary endeavour seemed to be leapfrogging one another in their speculation, on occasions building on each other in remarkable ways, which would be the satellites, ships, atomic bombs. The first science fiction of which we know was written by Lucian of Samothrace, which I'm going to have to look up. So it's Schopenhauer and him, a Syrian-Roman rhetorician whose tales offer interstellar wars, kidnappings by extraterrestrials, a trip to the moon, a pastiche of some of those more outlandish tales in the Odyssey. It is called True History because the whole story is nothing but lies. Now, one would say is that if Rome was embracing science, it had a choice between science or bullshit. Can I say rhetoric? Vis-a-vis, it's untestable. It's by strength of argument, i.e. he who bullshits the loudest. A character by the name of Endymion, E-N-D-Y, Mion, Endymion, describes how he has been carried away to the moon while he has slept. But since escaped, he plans to make war on the people of the sun, whose king Phaethon refused to allow him to colonize Venus. In ensuring the Titanic struggle, the people triumph, and Pantheon builds a high wall to prevent the light from his domain ever reaching the moon, thus casting it into permanent darkness. Well, this is interesting because this gives an idea that these objects, they may still be spherical, but they are spheres from which life and complexity comes across. It is a viewpoint which is not ascribing to the realm, the heavenly realm. So once you go to the heavenly realm, things obey the law. They always travel in circles, and Galileo believed this. And this is important to know, that both Newton, Galileo, Einstein had these things. So for instance, Einstein, we live in a double universe, and Einstein only saw one. He saw a fantastic universe, but he only saw one. And you go all the way back here. And now here, and we've got this sort of two-dimensional view of science, but at this stage where the light sources were points of light in space, they weren't imagined as planets orbiting or anything like that, but this sounds interesting. In the ensuing Titanic struggle, the people triumph, and also those other literary lines of ancient times, both of whom precede Lucian, Cicero, the dream of Scipio, and Pytrias, the face of the moon disk, had also written works of speculation about celestial bodies, but these were non-fiction. Okay. Yeah, oh, well, I would say there's the idea of complete fiction. This is good, yeah. So I do contest that Parmenides is not necessarily fiction, but it's a fictional revelation. I think it is fictional. Okay. To find anyone else among these early imaginers who wrote science fiction about the time of Lucian, so far as we can judge, we have to travel around the globe to Zhang Heng, AD 78 to 139, the great Chinese court astronomer who, in his story Meditation on the Mystery, describes the journey beyond the sun. Many centuries later, Kepler would pick up again on the idea of space travel when he wrote at the beginnings of the story called The Dream, involving a boy's trip to the moon. Far out! So, this is some of the things I found that Kepler didn't have so much problems with Catholics. It's the Protestants. And he also had problems that he was saying elliptical, and Galileo required circular, because Galileo had Aristotle's views. So he goes here, and he began to write A Boy's Trip to the Moon. The 17th century saw a proliferation of epic tales of interplanetary adventure. Wow, a fad that, fueled by the explosion of scientific inquiry and attention given by its writers of all kinds, to continue full to the 18th century. In 1705, Daniel Defoe published The Consolidator, the memoirs of sundry transactions from the world in the moon, in which he anticipates a machine powerful enough to reach a then-distant satellite. 20 years on, Jonathan Swift, the publisher of Gulliver's Travels, in which perhaps for the first time, even if only in jest, the writer contemplates the idea that both the Earth and the Sun are mortal. One of the fears of the people of Lilliput, for instance, is that the face of the Sun will by degrees be covered with its own effluent and give no more light to the world, which is interesting. So, the interesting thing is that the Sun does produce pollution, but the pollution is packed inside it. The centre of the Sun, Sun pollution, is helium, and that helium falls to the centre of the Sun. It's quite interesting to see. So the centre of the Sun is solidly filling with helium. When Gulliver visits the Great Academy of Legado, he finds members live in dread of a comet with a tail 10,014 miles long, travelling so close to the Sun, acquiring 10,000 times the heat of red iron, enough to burn up the Earth. Now, this is really interesting in terms of the Academy is the New Atlantis Academy. Isn't that amazing? When they meet an acquaintance in the morning, Gulliver reports, the first question is about the Sun's health. How is he looking at it setting and rising? And what hopes have they avoided the stroke, which is approaching comet, of the approaching comet? But that is not the only troubling scenario. Swift goes on to satirize their fears about the possible demise of the sun from sheer exhaustion of fuel, an extraordinarily persistent idea, albeit one Swift himself does not seem to take too seriously. By the 19th century, speculative writers had started to consider the sun a heavenly body like any other. William Herschel, the inventor of photography, and what a genius, not a photographer, of snapshot photographer, he had a few other terms gone from my head. Although not meaning to write science fiction, left science well behind when he suggested the sun might be inhabited. E. Walter Maunder of the Maunder Minimum, okay, this is when the glaciation, was he a janitor? I think he may have been a janitor. I think he was a janitor in... Summarize what Herschel had proposed. Quote, he conceived that it was possible that the stores of light and heat might be confined to a relatively thin shell in the upper atmosphere, and that below this shell a screen of clouds might so check radiation downwards that it would be possible for an inner nucleus to exist which should be cool and solid. This fancied inner globe could then necessarily enjoy perpetual light and a climate which knew no variation from pole to pole. To its inhabitants, the entire heavens would generally be luminous, the light not being concentrated into any one part of the vault. And it was supposed that, ignorant of time, a happy race might flourish, cultivating fast-spread solar fields in perpetual daylight. But we know it corresponds in not a single detail to actual facts. Well, can I say that we have a luminous shell, which is the... cosmic microwave background. So go figure. Isn't that beautiful? Isn't that beautiful? And we have cooled, and the only way we have cooled is by expansion. So the Big Bang was hot, and we have expanded like fridge cooling, by expansion cooling, but we can see that outer shell of brightness is beautiful. So Herschel, you are right. And Maunder is pretty amazing. Accurate or not, this might seem a promising area for fiction, but writers left it alone. Jules Verne, who might have expected to be curious about the sun, actually had a little to say about it, though he does mention, somewhat startlingly, in 2000 Leagues Under the Sea, in a sequel to The Mysterious Island, a romance rather than a work of science fiction, Verne writes, the effect of the equinoxes, the contrasting natures of solar and terrestrial, meantime, the rotation of the Earth, using the gamma until the time, but imaginatively it's about the star was outside his orbit. Do you like the outside his orbit? It's beautifully put. A host of other 19th century novelists tried their hands at science fiction writing. Kipling. So Kepler wrote science fiction. Kepler wrote science fiction. With The Night Mail and Easy as ABC, Poe, Fenimore, Cooper, Twain, Melville and Henry James. But a majority of meditative work that draws on the sun, one has to visit and wait until 1895 when a London publisher paid £100, no small sum for a young man just out of college, for a story of some of 38,000 words, one of the most memorable science fiction times ever written, The Time Machine, by H.G. Wells, of course. H.G. Wells, who died in 46, had penned at least three previous versions of the story for various magazines, but in the book, form it mesmerized the readers in public. No one had actually written a tale quite like it before. A product of its time, it was distinct, and of a distinct sensibility of its author, already a propagandist for his fiction that the future will ever be a direct outcome of existing social forces. It was dystopian socialist outpouring of science fiction. Isn't that beautiful? And we believe that now, obviously. We believe that this is so important. We act now before our grandchildren are told of global warming and stuff like that. Wells imagines the inventor who discovers how to transport himself in the future and return, starting off in seemingly stable days of the 1890s and ultimately travelling 30 million years forward in time. In this far-off world, never named, the time traveller sees the last living things on a dying Earth, which has come to rest in the face of the sun. one hemisphere ever seared, the other lost to eternal cold and darkness. In the former, menacing crab-like creatures wander blood-red beaches amid intensely green vegetation. The time traveller jumps yet further forward to see the sun growing ever dimmer and more crimson. But this is where science fiction has got this dual theme that allows you to speculate, bring these ideas together, but it's also closely controlled because science fiction is the realm of the researcher. The researcher to the disbeliever, the person who concedes advanced technology, thinks, can discount that person, that researcher is just dabbling in misguided science fiction. This is a quote. At last a steady twilight brooded over the earth, a twilight only broken now and then by a comet led across the daring sky. The band of light had indicated the sun's long since disappeared, for the sun had ceased to set. It simply rose and fell in the west and grew ever broader and more red. At last, some time before I stopped, the sun, red and very large, halted motionlessly upon the horizon, a vast dome glowing with dull heat, and now and then suffering a monumental extinction. At one time it had, for a little while, grown more brilliantly again, but it speedily reverted to a sullen red heap. I perceived, by the slowing down of its rising and setting, that the works of the tidal drag was done. The sun sees the tidal drag. Isn't that beautiful? That's how the tides are just sapping rotational energy out of the earth. Isn't it amazing? The earth had come to rest. One faced the sun. Even in our own time, the moon faces the earth. Isn't that, you know, this is so beautifully, he's educating exactly what it is. So here's the picture first, and I think I might actually do this going forward. Let's finish. So I travelled, stopping ever and again, in great strides of 1,000 years or more, drawing on the mystery of the earth's fate, watching with strange fascination suns grow larger and duller in the western sky, and life of the old earth ebb away. Isn't that beautiful? Okay, so you got to really, really think about that. But this is true. Now, although you may think this is not true, this is true for Alpha Centauri C, or Proxima, as it's called, and that has a tidally locked planet. Wells was, in fact, expanding on a theme that had fascinated writers for at least since Swiss, the question of how long the sun, and hence our planet, might last. Several other works of Wells' time, such as the eminent astronomer Camille Flammington Omega, and George Wallace's The Last Days of Earth, 1901, and William Hopes Hodgson's The House on the Borderland, rest on the assumption that the sun is sustained by chemical combustion, and that will come a time within the foreseeable future that civilization, when it will burn itself out. Winston Churchill, in his novel What? Savonarola, who envisioned a depleted sun. He posited his gradual process of extinction as an opportunity, a challenge a man can't meet, given certain moral and physiological qualities. In one episode, I've got to get that first science fiction writer, Schopenhauer, sorry for this. This is my brain going in. Now, I don't know, you may be very good, but my memory is not that good. It's Samo Sata. My God, Winston Churchill wrote a science fiction novel? In one episode, his pregnant, a highly idealized version of himself, glazes at Jupiter through a telescope and thinks of the incomprehensible periods of time that would elapse before the cooling process would render life possible on its surface, which could conceivably lead to some kind of extraterrestrial utopian. However, in the end, he concludes that even if this came about inexorably, the perfect development of life would end in death, the whole system, the whole universe itself, and one day be cold and lifeless, as burned out as a firework. This meditation might almost be preceded at the end of Wells' story, but both melancholic delusions written in abysses, depressives, two great men dedicated to improving the common lot. Wow. Winston Churchill wrote a science fiction work, so I've got to read that. Savonarola. Okay, on my podcast, Winston Churchill writes on space. Churchill was a great fan of Wells' work, borrowing occasional phrases from it, such as the gathering storm, and in 1931 declaring that he would pass an exam on his hero. In 1947, he paid an amusing tribute to Wells as a seer. His Time Machine is a wonderful book, and in the same class as Gulliver Travels, it is one of the books I would like to take with me to the Purgatory. Wells, for his part, created a caricature of Churchill in Men Like Gods. Peter? Hello, darling, yeah?
Can we just quickly come and... It's Fiona Wood on the card, isn't it?
It's a brief break there. Just let's contemplate two things. There's two aspects to this. One is that we have H.G. Wells writing a caricature of Winston Churchill in 1923, obviously, you know, Gallipoli getting lots of people to die for him. You know, he's a master of death, as far as I can see, but you've got this complexity here. You've got Winston Churchill writing science fiction. So if I said that Winston Churchill was a science fiction writer, I would be shut down. So what's interesting here is that this facts get buried in, if you like, a time capsule, a capsule of logic, and it's actually packed with, if you can imagine, packing for the apocalypse. Some of the food in here was never edible. The quantum mechanics, the physics is not edible, but some of it's got this structure that you can archaeologically dig out. And what is more interesting is that archaeology is archaeology of two times. That is, you understand the time that was, and you also understand the time that is now. So as an archaeologist, you have to negotiate what you find, reshape it, and fit it in to society. So you take what's old and fit it in. And what's happening here is that I can say that that your society is something where you've got a vast number of people, and they do not know this. So this is a pretty amazing thing for me. This is something I will have to do. By the 1930s, it was known that the sun produced heat by thermonuclear fusion, and it would one day die out. Claire Ashton, one of the few women in the genre, produce Phoenix, a poignant story about a journey through space to rekindle a fading star, an idea used yet again by Jean Wolfe's series Book of a New Sun, 1980 to 83. Sounds like, so it would be a disastrously boy. Let's see. The film and television have shared interest in the idea. There's been a little interest in the sun per se, although Star Wars, Luke Skywalker, is seen across the vast expanse of his home planet with two setting suns. The film is almost understandably concentrating on space travel and trans-spatial rivalries. The premise in 2007 movie Sunshine, directed by Danny Boyle and Slumdog Millionaire fame, is the sun rapidly losing power, so a manned rocket is sent to space to set off a rejuvenating thermonuclear explosion. Our sun is dying, our purpose is to create the star within a star, as one scientist put it. The writer Alex Garland kindly took me around the set, a few acres of warehouses in southeast London. Every detail, even the ship's oxygen gardens, have been checked by astronomers a possible first. That makes me easy. Oh, I remember that book. What is it? The Sun Queen. No. Okay, we're not yet. What's the book that he wrote? Sunshine. God, that was a bad movie. I couldn't read it. Watch at the time. Although the solar surface temperature has been established in the 1890s, John Maston, who describes the sun voyage in Through the Sun in Airship, 1809, and Craner set the Sun Queen on a sunspot. From the 1930s on, science fiction producers were beginning to be recognized as something as more than just enthusiastic amateurs. Do you know what? I think if you could, organize this powerful energy generation by having a spike, a reflection spike and shade, using the shade and reflection of radiation to concentrate and create a really powerful sun saw, I think, I can't see why not. Okay, from the 1930s, the science fiction practitioners were beginning to recognize as something more than just enthusiastic amateurs. In November 1945, editorial and influential magazine Astounding Stories of Super Science, the great science fiction editor John W. Campbell roundly declared of the previous decade, science practitioners were suddenly recognized by their neighbors as not quite such wild-eyed dreamers as they have been thought, and in many soul-satisfying cases became neighborhood experts. Clifford Dismack's Sunspot Purge, 1940s, and Philip Latham's Disturbing Sun, 1959, correlated events on Earth with sunspot spikes. Robert Hunt's Six Connected Stories, The Man Who Sold the Moon, in 1950, I remember that, was it, there was one, was it Isaac Asimov? Someone put a Coca-Cola and a Pepsi advertising sign on the moon. Daring Adventures of Baldwin of Tomorrow, a world where energy for the sun will be converted directly into power, ends with a chart of future history from 1951 to 2064, forecasting weather control in 2017, interstellar space travel in 2010, followed by consolidation of the solar system. In 1950s began a second golden age of science fiction, and both Carl Rhonda Smith, a pseudonym greatly counter-Chinese psychological warrior, Paul Lindberger of 1930 to 1966, Poole Anderson, who died in 2001, belonged to this period. In Swiss Story, The Lady Who Sailed the Soul, he depicts voyages crossing the heavens on the wings of a solar wind. Now, this is true. Things. I remember Asimov and Australia went with a solar race. And there was a wombat. I remember an Asimov story from that. Okay, as recently in November 2009, the science correspondent of the New York Times wrote that about a year from now, if all goes well, a box the size of a loaf of bread will pop a rocket some 500 miles above the Earth. There, in the vacuum, it will unfold four triangular sails as shiny as moonlight, only barely more substantial. It will slowly rise on the sunbeam and move across the sky. It will mark a milestone dream that is almost as old as the rocket itself, and romantic to navigate the cosmos on the winds of sunlight. By the time you read this, science fiction could have become science fact. Yeah, okay. I don't know. It's just people. I don't know. When you design a bridge, you've got to measure G and the strength of steel. What I think, so when you design a bridge, you have to take at least a thought of how far things are crossing, the stability of the soil. So I think as an engineering project, there is no excuse. Because people haven't done it, it's not an excuse to say it's not done. I don't know if anyone would understand that. Okay. Anderson, equally happily writing within classical science fiction or the new world of science fantasy, interested himself in the plausible non-Earth-like planets, the benefits of space exploration and faster-than-light travel beyond the solar system he regarded as a hostile barren mess. In his tale, The Sun Invisible, A World Without Stars, and Day of Burning, the science fiction flick I was trying to remember. It's something or other tomorrow. So this is stroke brain, where thoughts are there trying to improve. And hopefully you can see me improve in reading. Okay. His space travels visit systems while a long way from home. He envisions the possibility of a solar system that has become the seat of interstellar empire, Earth turned into an Eden by global warming, with a sun as innocent bystander, and then the sun is hardly ever guilty participants. Well, this is But he was saying that global warming, it was only as a term in 73, which is interesting. Did he use it? A similar confidence in human ingenuity appears in Theodore L. Thomas, The Weatherman, 1962, which features technicians who skim the solar surface in Cessna boats to modify its radiation. A characteristically optimistic vision of the chemical engineering turned patent lawyer. Philip E. High, Prodigal Sun, S-U-N, a sudden outpouring of intense solar radiation heads towards Earth. The scientists have to create a shield of gas in the upper atmosphere. Other writers have imagined the sun heating up rather than cooling down and disappearing, which it does. Solar Burns Sun Driver, featuring a spectacularly close encounter with the man between man and the star, shows an exceptional grasp of modern science. In 1 in 300, John D. McDonald followed 10 people who take off for Mars shortly after it has been discovered the world is doomed. Earth, by this time, it was dead, boiled, sterile. More fiction has been written about Mars than any other heavenly body. Robert Silverberg, Thomas the Proclaimer, one of the three separately authored novellas that make up the day the sun stood still in 1972, as the sun stopped in its path to become a potential flytrap for spaceships. Oh my God. None of the authors had much interest in exploring the sun for its own sake, or making the centre of the story because it was happening within it. This is true even of Hughes King Mill's The End of the World in 1934 and Larry Niven's Constant Moon in 1971, both based on the idea that the sun might go nova. One exception is Ray Bradbury, who in 1953 tailed Golden Apples of the Sun, sends another Icarus thither to touch and steal part of it forever. Left with the job of beginning to venture to life on the page, Bradbury makes a game, if not wholly convincing, attempt depicting the huge metallic cup held by a strangely amphimortic hand which reaches up to scoop the required amount of precious gas. What was this one? Oh my God, it proves unequal to the task. And the story ends with a rocket heading home to take Earth a gift of fire that might burn forever. Oh God, this is so dumb. Why, the captain asks, is the whole exercise of journey to the sun playing tag and hitting and running? This time, Bradbury prose gives us a vivid answer, because the atoms we work with in our hands on Earth are pitiful. The atomic bomb is pitiful and small, and only the sun knows what we want to know. This is, well, just interesting. 73, the heliostat. I just know a whole lot of presence. This is not the only time the sun has been credited with consciousness, but it rates as the one with the more compelling. I think it's not whether we believe a consciousness of the sun. This is the more important question as far as I can see. Somewhere between wide-eyed dreaming and scientific forecast ties the notions of igniting new suns to replace the current one. In 1957-8, Friedrich Pohl and Moore Kornblumth co-author Wolfbane, a story set in 2203 after a rogue planet populated by machines known as pyramids has kidnapped the Earth and the Moon and taken them off to interstellar space. The sun grew too distant to be of use, and out of the cold, the Moon, the pyramid aliens built a new tiny sun sky, a 5-year sun that burned out and was replaced again and again by endless again. The novel begins the character ruminating on whether the latest sun will be regenerated. Oh God. That's so dumb. I can't believe you'd be bothered reading it. In a week, astronomers knew something was happening. In a month, the moon sprang into flame because it became a new sun, beginning to be needed. For already, parent sol was visibly more distant. In a few years, it was only one of another star amongst many. When the inferior little sun had burned to a clinker, they would hang a new one in the sky. It happened every 5 clock years, more or less. It was the same old moon turned sun, but it burnt out and the fires needed to be rekindled. The first of the suns had looked down on Earth, a population of 10 billion, 70 billion. Now, as the sequence of the sun waxed and waned, there were changes, climate fluctuation, all but immeasurable differences in the quality and kind of radiation of the new source. Visitors of Isle of Pole and Canada carry their notion, and the story soon takes a more conventional turn, but it was an interesting variation on the theme of suns burning down. The subject that would be taken up and dealt with more ambitiously in the work of Isaac Asimov and Arthur C. Clarke. The two kings of 20th century science fiction, are they believing? I think Arthur C. Clarke, 2001. Asimov, who died in 92, was born pretty set some Blinsk Oblast. I like the Oblast. There's a Jewish Oblast. These are Soviet era camps in the Soviet Union. But in 1953, his family moved to the U.S., where his parents bought a succession of corner shops, most of which sold sci-fi in the heyday of the old-fashioned pulps. By the time of 11, Asimov was composing his own works of story. Isn't that amazing? So you've got Benjamin Franklin and Faraday and now Asimov. These are all who involved in publication. In all, he would write more than 500 books and estimated 9,000 letters and postcards, publishing works in every major category, the Dewey Decimal System except philosophy. By the age of 21, he had written 31 stories. My status was nothing more than a steady and perhaps hopefully third rater. Then, on the 17th of March 1941, he visited the offices of Astounding, whose editor, John Campbell, had an idea he wanted to put to the publishing author. He had become across a quotation in the 8th chapter of Ralph Waldo Emerson called Nature. In the first chapter, Emerson said, "If the stars should appear one night in 1,000 years, how would men believe and adore and preserve for many generations the remnants of the city of God?" Campbell asked me if it should disappear. If stars should appear one night, 1,000 years, okay. Campbell asked me to read it and I said, "What do you think would happen, Asimov, if men were to see stars for the first time in 1,000 years? I thought and drew blank. I said, "I don't know." Campbell said, "I think they would go mad. I want you to write a story about that." Next day, Asimov started Nightfall, at 28 pages, 13,300 words. And 23 years later, the science fiction writers of America would vote by a considerable margin the best of its ever kind, in which it had been so frequently reprinted that, as Asimov himself recognized, it is now so well known that nothing like it can be published again, although Asimov later wrote a novel-length treatment of the same story, fleshing out many details, including the final catastrophe. I confess to finding characters tiresome and the plot lackluster, but along the way it does pose some interesting ideas, particularly about the possibility of the existence of planets that have multiple suns. I don't quite understand. What is it? If stars should appear one night in 1,000 years, how would men believe and adore, preserve for many generations the remnants of the city of God? Okay, well, this is actually exactly right. This is the thing that the supernova, stars exploding in the heaven, created great furor. Tycho, the great fervent, there. This thing. The action takes place in Syro City, on a planet Langash, which over the ages had been bathed in perpetual life from six suns. They are in constant motion, so as at least one of them is always shining. But when the sun opens, when the story opens, one by one, five of the six have passed out of sight. Then Beta, the final sun, disappears. The whole planet will face a mind-breaking night. The people of Langash totally lack the mental equipment to deal with such a moment and are posed to become the latest of a series of 9 civilizations that have flowered at the height of their cultures. This is really interesting because rather than disappearing, the planet could be in an unstable orbit and be sent out into space, because we now know there's heaps of dark planets flung through space. Langash's multiple suns have real-life counterparts, as we know. In 2006, a professor of astrophysics reported that his researchers continue to discover systems outside our own, at least one planet that has more than one star. In the most recent HD 188753, lies 149 light years away from the constellation Cygnus Swan. And it's headed by three sons. Well, that is absolutely amazing. Because it's a fairly simple that you, to get a stable, non-chaotic system, you have to have a diagonalizable Hamiltonian. So, and how you do that without getting things, I don't know. The theme of replenishing or replacing a dying sun needs the idea of making a moon into a sun, as occurred in Wolfman, had early been taken up by Arthur C. Clarke, who died in 2008. Well, there he is. He survived I didn't know when he died. And his 1951 novel, The Sands of Mars, The Seas of Venus, oh my god, The Sands of Mars. Now remember these novels, they were pretty crap, sorry. Story scientists are the work of Project Dawn, which involves the ignition of the moon Phobos to burn for at least 1,000 years to serve as the second sun for Mars, and the hope that the extra heat, together with the mass growth of oxygen-generating plants, will eventually make Martian atmosphere breathable. The science of the sands of Mars is in some ways ahead of Wolfbane's, with not surprising given the author's stature. Arthur C. Clarke was born in Somerset, and like Asimov, grew up on a diet of American sci-fi pulp. He served as a radar specialist that involved an early warning defense system in the Battle of Britain, and he continued to be fascinated by spaceflight. His early stories appeared in magazines between 37 and 45, his first official sale coming in 46, and from 51 he devoted himself full-time to writing. Many of his later books he wrote or edited over 70 features a technologically advanced but blinking mankind confronted by a superior alien intelligence. Although overall his writing characterized the optimistic view that science will enable humankind to explain the universe, I think not. I really think not. There are certain things that we can't do, or not going to be able to do, is build a bridge, a road bridge across the Pacific, which will allow you to drive from Sydney to LA. That's just as dumb. Okay. Around 1972, after sharing a cab in Manhattan, Asimov and Clarke together published their Treaty of Park Avenue, which became tongue-in-cheek. Asimov was required to insist that Clarke was the best science fiction writer in the world, reserving second place for himself, while Clarke had to insist that Asimov was the best science fiction, reserving second place for himself. Thus, the dedication of Clarke's book, report on Planet 3, in accordance with the terms of the Clarke-Asimov Treaty, the second best science writer declares that this book is the second best science fiction of the second best fiction writer. But the implicit acknowledgement that Clarke was the better fiction writer is justified. Okay, seven of his stories directly concern the sun. One early tale, The Star, published in November 55 after being entered into an altogether discounted in the Observer short story competition. The action begins on a spaceship. No other survey ship has been so far from Earth. His mission was to visit the remnants of a supernova, and the crew finds a single small world circling a star of immense distance, which has once been host to intelligent life. Long perished inhabitants have left behind a huge vault, evidence of a civilization that in many ways must have been superior to our own. As he leaves the supernova, the chief astrophysicist, a Jesuit priest, isn't that beautiful, reflects, isn't that a Jesuit priest? You know what? I think they will, no matter what happens, I think the Jesuits will be at the end of civilization. They have this way. It's my thing. I know the answers that my colleagues will give when they get back to Earth. They will say the universe has no purpose and no plan, that since hundreds of suns explode every year in a galaxy, at this very moment, some race is dying in the depths of space. Whether the race has done good or evil during its lifetime will make no difference. In the end, there is no divine justice, there is no God. Yet, of course, what we have seen proves nothing of the sort. Isn't that beautiful? Armed with a ship full of computer-generated information, he calculates the exact date of the explosion that caused the supernova, which must have outshone all the masses of the stars and galaxies. The story ends with the revelation that it must have been the very same time that one of the shepherds and the wise men saw it above Bethlehem. That central conceit is clever enough, but what is most interesting is Clarke's near, clear, early fascination with the yet-to-be-mapped worlds and the possibility of other suns. Isn't that good? You can imagine people, that's rather cheap. I'd say conceit. I think it's a good word for it. In 1958, published a slight case of sunstroke, a minor offering, but one that uses huge power of reflective sunlight as a plot device. In the capital of Latin Republic of Pervia, a crucial football match is in progress, and passions are running high. Then, the referees, obviously paid off by the visiting side, disallows a Peruvian goal. A mistake, and the hats and souvenir program bought by his home side supporters make a tinfoil and sends 5,000 makeshift mirrors trained home. I never knew then just how much energy there is in sunlight. It's well over the horsepower of every square yard facing the sun. Most of the heat falling on one side of the enormous stadium had been diverted to a single area of the late ref. He must have intercepted at least 1,000 horsepower of raw heat. They play football for keeps in Pervia. Now look, what I was going to say here is that there's fundamental laws of physics saying that you, no matter what you can do, you can never concentrate sunlight to be hotter than the surface of the sun, because that defies Saint Law. I don't know. I've got to go back and restudy this. So you have to really understand that. In terms of wattage, it's if you hold a mirror in front of you, it covers, say, 100 degrees of rotation, it's at arm's length, and it's on your face, that's as hot as you will get from a stadium. Does that make sense? Because it's inverse square law, you can't tell the distance. It's roughly. Okay. Clark's other solar oriented stories are interspersed in 2001, Sagas, 2001, A Space Odyssey, 2010, 2060. Odyssey 3, 3001, The Final Odyssey, all of which written between 68 and 97. This 1960 story, Summertime on Icarus, has a more serious tone, building the original fable. Now, why he doesn't include this fable more in Darius, imprisoned with his son Icarus on a high tower, the vengeful King Minos, constructs two sets of wings, securing them to his own, his son's soldiers with wax. Darius warns Icarus that he should not fly too high, the wax will melt. Father and son lift, exulting his newborn freedom, the boy sighs upwards. Sure enough, blazing sun softens the wax, Icarus plunges headlong to the sea. The Prometheus, and tries to get close to the sun by riding a nearby orbiting Icarus, asteroid Icarus, the hottest piece of real estate in the solar system. And here's a quote. Here was a unique opportunity for a research ship to get within a mere 17 million miles of the sun. Okay, we're 150 billion miles. Oh, I don't know what that means, miles. Okay, well, it's protected from the fury by a 2-mile thick shield of rock and iron. In the shadow of Icarus, the ship could ride safely around the center of fire. I should think of why not land on Mercury and have a heat pump on Mercury. You can easily do it. The overreaching seems destined to fail, but Clark must have been in a forgiving mood, for even when things do go wrong, he allows this main character, astronaut Sherrod, to survive with the help of a large metallic foil radiation screen. Although not before he becomes terrifyingly and closely grilled alive, and the readers are given a lesson on the dangers of getting so close to ultimate power. Clark's next solar adventure, The Wind from the Sun, 1964, describes a yacht race with a difference. I do actually remember, I've read this book, The Wind from the Sun. It was in Analog magazine. A half square mile of sails runs before the storm of radiation blowing from the sun. Again, Clark was ahead of his time and most scientists. Deep within the surface of the sun, enormous forces were gathering. Any moment, the energy of millions of hydrogen bombs would burst forth an awesome explosion, the solar flare, throwing Millions of miles an hour, the invisible fireball may sometimes be the size of Earth, would leap from the sun and head across space. Although in his adult life, Clark argued that humanity's destiny lay beyond the confines of Earth, hence 2001 books. His work, such as his detailed forecast of telecommunication satellites, published in the Wireless World magazine in 1945, 2 decades before one ever orbited Earth, was often prophetic. Borrowing the phrase from the 19th century psychologist philosopher William James, he once suggested that exploring the solar system would serve as a moral equivalent to war, giving an outlet to energies that might otherwise bring nuclear holocaust. Whoa, is that not true? If it seems far-fetched, consider 2004 George W. Bush proposed sending humans to Mars, and Richard Branson currently is proposing space flights for paying passengers. Star Virgin Galactic, offshoot of Virgin Atlantic, is due to the VSS Enterprise, a homage to Kirk's fictional ship. 6 passengers, hybrid rockets, will come in 2011. The sun is somewhere off, however, the rocket will blast 68 miles above the Earth. Passengers will enjoy 4.5 minutes of wakefulness, a stupendous views over 2.5 hour journey that will cost them $3,000 per head. Branson promises that within 10 years the price will get down to $40,000. Already 340 seats have been booked. Another company, Big Elo Space, plans to launch an inflatable space hotel by 2015. Complete ridiculous Americans. For Clark's most memorable solar story, we have to go back to 1958. And out of the sun, the narrator aboard the spaceship within then believed twilight zone of Mercury. Part of the team, I think it's called the Terminator Zone, exploring what goes within the sun at the heart of a sunset cycle. From the far X-rays to long radio waves, we set ourselves traps and stairs. As soon as the sun thought of something new, we were ready for it. So we imagined. And it follows a lesson story about meditations, the man's attitude to the sun, and still worth listening to. These great clouds of ice gas moving far out from the sun are completely invisible to the eye and even the most sensitive photographic plates. They are ghosts that briefly haunt the solar system during a few hours of existence, and if they do not reflect our radar waves or disturb our magnetors, we should never know they were there. He picks up on the radar scanning a little echo outside the previous records of the solar phenomenon, which he reckons is a glass cloud about 500 miles long and half a finger in width, and seemingly to exhibit the characteristics of an intelligent being. Oh my god, Boltzmann being. Today, the idea no longer seems strange to me, for what is life but organized energy? Does it matter what the energy takes, whether it is chemical, as we know on Earth, or purely electrical? Oh god, that's mad. Who's this? Clark. Only a pattern of importance of the substance itself. It has no significance. But at that time, I do not think of this. I am conscious only of the vast, overwhelming wonder as I watch this creature of the sun live out the final moments of existence. As soon as the clouds hit Mercury, the entire of its daylight side, it will be dispersed, destroyed forever. Was it intelligent? Could it understand the strange doom that it had? Oh, we're going to catch the end of this. Fallen it? Perhaps. In those few seconds, it knew that something strange was ahead of it, for it had begun to change. It may be that I was looking at the brain of a mindless beast in its vain convulsions of fear, or a godlike being making at peace with the universe. Okay. Whatever one makes of Clark's flight of imagination, this science fiction of the highest order, thrilling as a story, yet in total less than 6 pages, scientifically accurate within the limits of addressing itself to the question of astronomers' fine planet today, J.G. Ballard, has asserted that sooner or later all the predictions of science fiction will come true. No way. A pardonable exaggeration. More accurate is Clark's observation that most technological achievements were preceded by people writing and imagining them. What we come to do with the sun, or to escape from it, may well play out scenarios that science fiction has already described. For instance, in one of his early short stories, Isaac Asimov imagines a technology that could reflect the sun's rays in space and transmit the energy back to Earth. Space-based power stations could be capable of to capture solar energy 24 hours a day and send it anywhere on our planet. At the time of the story in 1941, launching such a system was not commercially viable, but in 2001, the Californian-based SolarRan Corporation contracted with Physics Pacific Gas and Electric to provide 200 megawatts of power, about half the output of an average coal-fired power, from a space station in space. SolarRan's deadline is 2016. Well, there you go. Isn't that pretty amazing? So I've read that story, I think, in one hit, an hour and 10 minutes, and hopefully, sorry to be it, but my rehab is going better. I read a little bit ahead, and then get some gist to put it together, and get some skills sorted in. That's an hour and 10 minutes. Thanks a lot for listening. Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.